Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Thoughtful Thursday here on Mind Talk. Every Thursday, you and I have the opportunity to meet an expert who shares with us information, expertise that will perhaps broaden our views and our perspectives. Certainly today is no different. I am very pleased to introduce to you Dr. Veronica Raji. Dr. Veronica is a clinical psychologist affiliated with Alvord Baker and Associates, which is a clinical practice in Maryland. There, Dr. Raji has done a substantial amount of work with children, families, educators, and more. She has extensive knowledge and experience working with ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. But today, we're going to be picking her brain about another area in which she is expert, and that is selective mutism. Dr. Raji, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here today, Pamela.
Well, let's start with what exactly is selective mutism?
Sure. So a selective mutism, if we think about, talk about the definition, it is a persistent failure in specific social situations where speaking is expected. So, for example, the school setting is obviously a common one. And this is despite speaking fluently in other situations. So what I see commonly when a parent arrives to our clinic for that first interview to discuss their concerns is they will often tell me their child is a chatterbox at home, that they can't stop talking, that they have lots to say, they're expressive, they enjoy the social interaction, but yet when in social situations that they are not comfortable in, for example, often school, sometimes public settings, sometimes family gatherings with extended family members, that child will either not speak at all or speak very selectively. For example, maybe whispering with one adult they have a little bit more comfort with, but not speaking at all with others. So we see these children with selective mutism can create sort of rigid rules or boundaries in terms of where they will speak and where they will not speak. And it varies a little bit by individual. So some kids will see, for example, in the school setting, will be very social non-verbally, so that they may participate in the physical movements with the, you know, songs. They may play, you know, again, through gestures and other nonverbal interactions with other students. They may smile, they may seem happy throughout the day, but there's no, but the verbal interaction is the fearful response there. For other kids, we see also an inhibition of the nonverbal social expression. So sometimes I go in to observe at a school and I will see a child who is very expressive outside of school, but has a stiff body posture, very awkward facial expression, avoids eye contact. So the disorder can manifest a little bit different depending on the child. Occasionally, there's misdiagnosis along the lines of an autism spectrum or a social communication type disorder. When diagnosticians are, you know, kind of observe the child just in that setting where they are the most inhibited because they look so different than they may look when they're comfortable. So that does occur on occasion. But so that's sort of the definition of selective mutism. And we know now that selective mutism is an anxiety disorder. So it's a fear of speaking. Way back when, historically, or maybe it's not too long ago, maybe 15, 20 years ago, selective mutism was thought to be possibly a disruptive behavior disorder, an oppositional problem, because we do see such resistance to speak people thought that this was just opposition. But we know now that it's not. The resistance is specific to the speech, and it comes because the child is scared, is uncertain, may be concerned about embarrassment when they speak. Those concerns that can really kind of spiral or become more ingrained as time goes on. So we see that while these kids do tend to, the research shows there's a predisposition towards anxiety. They tend to be more what we call behaviorally inhibited. As toddlers and young children, they tend to be more cautious and wary, stay close to their parents, a little bit less likely to take risks and kind of get out there, approach situations. So we do see that temperament is kind of a precursor, predictor of selective mutism. But then the development and the maintenance of the disorder has a very behavioral explanation in that, every time the child does not answer a question, that lack of response becomes reinforced over time. So in other words, the child doesn't speak, their anxiety is reduced because they were able to stay in that comfort zone, and therefore they want to repeat that response again. And they also start to develop, in many cases, what I've seen, this role as the non-speaker. So unfortunately, in an effort to help the child and sort of make them feel as comfortable as possible, adults as well as peers will often attempt to rescue the child from speaking. So I've actually entered a classroom where a child might say to me, "Oh, don't, Johnny, he won't speak to you." Or if you ask a direct question of the child, the peer will jump in to answer that question.
I see.
So there also ends up being a lot of enabling or accommodation around those behaviors in the environment, trying to sort of, naturally and understandably trying to support the child in feeling comfortable, but inadvertently reinforcing that pattern of non-speech.
Well, tell me about the children who actually have this experience, because we are talking about, at least right now, we are talking about children. So what is it about that child's life or environment or whatever it is that teaches him or her to be so anxious, so reticent, that this becomes a part of their experience?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a combination of factors. We do know that there is a genetic or biological predisposition. So these kids, even you see in infancy, every child is different, right? Some kids are easy to soothe, and they breastfeed easily, and they develop a regular sleep pattern. And other kids are a little bit different, and they can be more difficult to soothe. They can be more cautious. They can, so every child has a little bit different temperament. So that's definitely a strong aspect of this. But certainly there is a big learning component. And the parents' interaction with the child also makes a big difference in terms of development of this condition. So parents who are also anxious themselves are often going to inadvertently model that behavior, and kids pick up on this. So the parent that may, what would be an example, a parent may lose their keys in the parking lot, right? There are different ways to respond to that, and children are observant. When they see their parent panic, feel a lack of control, feel uncertainty as to what to do, and I think the key is difficulty coping. When I talk to parents, I always say that nobody is perfect, and you're not expected to be perfect, and that's not what your child needs. But what your child does need is a coping model. So we want to show our children that despite feeling naturally some nervousness or anxiety in different situations, right, feelings are normal, feelings are natural, it's okay to have a feeling. we can problem solve, we can cope. And so I teach parents how to verbalize their coping. I'm feeling anxious. Well, let's see, what can I do? I think this might work. Or, you know, I'm going to take a few breaths, calm myself down, and then we're going to figure this out. So I think being able to cope and demonstrating to children that in a variety of situations are manageable and we can problem solve and you can handle, I think is important. I think the other piece that often happens is what we call overprotection, right? Parents have the desire, again, very naturally, to protect and soothe and nurture, and that's a wonderful thing. What happens, though, is sometimes that that protection moves, you know, over to the end or more extreme place where the child isn't given enough room and enough space to check out, to explore, to realize that they can struggle a bit with something. They're not rescued, but yet it works out, right? Every time we stay in a situation that is uncomfortable, right, we're getting outside of our comfort zone, we have to struggle with it a little bit, kind of figure out, how can I handle this? We have to also deal with the physiological piece of what we're feeling and work through that. And every time we do that, that's a learning experience. We're figuring out how to self-soothe. We're figuring out how to cope. And what happens with parents that are anxious is sometimes they do that coping and soothing for the child. For example, the parent that every time the child might call out at night comes running in and stays with the child until they fall back asleep might be an example, right? So we want to find ways to allow kids to start to figure those things out on their own. And when we overprotect, we're sort of setting up, helping kids learn a connection that maybe we don't want them to learn, that I need mom and dad to protect me. The world is a dangerous place. I don't know what to do, or I'm not going to be able to cope if I tried this on my own. So I think by parents taking a step back, we're teaching kids that, yes, you know, my parent believes I can do this. I can cope. I will be okay.
So, in fact, overprotection of a child may, in fact, have the reverse impact that the parent is hoping to create. It can certainly help a child to be more vulnerable to the world around them rather than to feel more safe and secure.
Absolutely. Yeah, when we're thinking about child anxiety, we want to think about how gradually we can encourage kids to get out there, right? And every child is different and every situation is different. And obviously we want to do that in an understanding and step-by-step way. So we're not, you know, so for example, the child that's afraid of the water, right? We could throw them into the water. We've all known probably adults or grandparents or people that have done it, you know, kind of just throw the child in the water. That's the best way to get you over your fear. So we're not talking about that, but we're talking about step-by-step encouragement of maybe the first step is putting your feet in the water and then moving up to your knees. And then so little by little and encouragement and praise and expressing the confidence in their child's abilities that, yes, they can take those steps, whatever the fear or the concern may be.
What is the impact, if any, of trauma on the experience of selective mutism? You know, often we will see on any number of television programs a child exposed to a trauma becomes suddenly mute, but then within the hour is suddenly able to speak after they're able to articulate the trauma. Is that realistic?
That is not the definition of selective mutism that we have, that our diagnostic manual has developed. That is a different form of mute behavior due to a different cause. So selective mutism is really a fear or a specific phobia of speaking, and it has to last at least 1 month, and that 1 month cannot be just during the first month of school, which can be the case for many kids.
Okay.
We know that selective mutism is not a result of trauma. There can be, just like with anything else, some co-occurrence at times. We do see that selective mutism is more often occurs with some other concerns, such as speech and language problems, and such as acquisition of a second language. So these can influence the development of that fear of speech. I've worked with many kids who are now very fluent in that second language, but yet that initial discomfort and concern with how they sounded when they spoke that second language in school led to them then exhibiting that selective mutism and becoming diagnosed with that condition. So, and similarly, speech and language problems, in many of these cases, it can be helpful to get a speech and language evaluation, because while SM is not synonymous with speech and language problems, they're two different conditions. Certainly, if a child has articulation problems or other concerns, that can influence the development of that fear and that concern with hearing the sound of your voice. So imagine sort of same thing with trauma. If a child experiences a specific trauma, it could lead to a short-term sort of mute behavior.
I see.
Or it could block, you know, kind of bloom into selective mutism if unaddressed. But ultimately, selective mutism is a phobia of speech. And I think kids with trauma, I would imagine, are not speaking due to an array of different reasons. It could be fear of saying something that might upset an adult, or to fear of reliving or talking about the trauma. And so all of those are different fears, different anxieties.
So it sounds like in the selective mutism arena, the child has a chronic experience of being anxious or fearful about speaking for any number of reasons.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And for those who, I'm sure we're both aware of parents who will see the selective mutism as their child being oppositional, certainly as you talked about earlier, their child not being as smart as perhaps the other siblings in the household or in the family. Their child can't have selective mutism because they, the parent, don't have it, or they're a good parent, so how could this be? I mean, there's so many things that can go on a parent's mind when their child is dealing with this experience. What do you say to those fears of parents?
Sure. I would say that, you know, again, we're all different as human beings, and we come to the table with different characteristics. And I think, you know, certainly there can be some advantages to an individual that has a more cautious, thoughtful, observant style. But however, you know, again, things can move into behaviors that become problematic over time, as selective mutism does. So what I would say that absolutely it's nothing for parents to feel badly about. I think that it's a form of anxiety, and there are many forms of anxiety, and anxiety is one of the most common mental health disorders that there is. So it's while selective mutism is a specific form of anxiety and is rare in and of itself, we see a variety of many variations of anxiety. And young children can be very prone to anxiety, especially as they move into preschool and kindergarten. It's a really new, it's a novel environment. They have not had those experiences before. Now they have to navigate interacting with teachers and interacting with peers, potentially a loud, large classroom, a lot going on. And every child develops a little bit differently. And for some kids, that is a more difficult environment. So I would say that certainly not to blame yourself, that it's something to just sort of recognize and observe if those problems are there, and to seek support, seek guidance, education on the topic, so that you know how to interact with that child and how you can support that child to come out of their shell and to make some of those changes over time.
Dr. Veronica Raji is a clinical psychologist affiliated with Alvord Baker and Associates in Maryland, which is a clinical practice in Maryland. We're going to take a break, Dr. Raji, and when we come back, I'd like to talk to you a little bit more about the way in which you'd like to see teachers or educators respond to the child who's experiencing selective mutism.
Absolutely.
Folks, don't go away. We'll be right back. Raji, we've been talking about the experience of selective mutism in terms of the child and in some respects in terms of how you'd like to see a parent think about this or respond. What about educators? How likely are educators to be the first person who would be aware that this might be an issue?
Educators are often the first individuals to notice that this is a concern, because again, parents are more likely to be in the more comfortable situations for these children at home, family gatherings. Parents do sometimes start to notice some concerns. For example, the child that goes to the restaurant but doesn't order, you know, cannot order the food, or at large family gatherings that refuse and is unable to speak to a large portion of the adults and family members there. But usually it is the teachers. Preschool, kindergarten, first grade are really common times where these concerns start to be noticed. One thing I would say to teachers is that if this lack of speech has been going on for more than a month or two, that is a really good sign that it is time to refer the parents, to talk with the parents about what they're observing, and to refer to a provider or an expert in the area of selective mutism, or just a good mental health professional that can coordinate treatment and do an evaluation. Because what we know about selective mutism is that left untreated, it can become, again, further ingrained, and that pattern can persist for years. And during that time, what can happen is we can see increased social problems for the child. If they're unable to interact with peers, they're going to have difficulty making friendships. If they're unable to talk to the adults and the teachers, I see commonly problems with testing, with the teacher saying, I don't know what the reading level of this child is because they won't read aloud to me. So there's a variety of different concerns that can develop. And again, the longer the child doesn't speak, the more reinforced that behavior becomes, and the child develops that role further.
Well, would you say that an educator is mandated to share this information with their colleagues and with the parents, or is this optional?
Well, I think it's definitely important. I mean, mandated is a strong word, but I would say it's clinically indicated. It is encouraged and supported, and I think it would be the appropriate next response as they observe these concerns. Because again, we see that that treatment is often most effective before the behavior has become further ingrained. So early on, we have the the greatest chance for success in treatment that is short term and that can improve functioning fairly quickly. And I do see teachers, and again, a lot of this is sort of natural responses to what they're observing, but especially preschool and kindergarten, right? Kids are so young, so teachers often tell parents, don't worry about it. Obviously, they want to calm the parents down. And you know, they're like, okay, your child is shy. They're not speaking right now, but they just need time. They need time to bloom. I'm going to keep them comfortable. And when they're ready, they will speak. So I think that is a very common response. But unfortunately, that typically does not work for a number of reasons. But one of the main ones is what we've been discussing in terms of comfort zone. Right. If we stay in our comfort zone, we're not gaining learning experiences. We're not realizing that we can do the thing that we're scared of, and we're not building confidence. And so kids, and of course young kids, you know, they're not to the point where they've developed that internal motivation often to say, okay, I'm going to take this step and I'm going to do this because I really want to make sure that I'm speaking, right? But they're not there yet. So we need to really support them and develop a treatment plan and program to encourage and help them to take those steps.
In the instance where a parent has been advised by the school that this may be an issue and the parent flat out refuses to accept that this is a possibility or refuses to accept an actual diagnosis if one is achieved, what then? Does the school have any recourse? I mean, certainly the child is being harmed, but does the school or the educator have any resource or any requirements?
That's a really good question. I mean, I think schools have an obligation to try to support a child in whatever way, whether it is a learning disability or another condition. I think the school can certainly take steps to do their own evaluation, and in many cases do. It's a great question. I know that parents do need to sign forms in order to agree with those formalized treatment plans, what we would call like a 504 or an individualized education plan. So if something of that nature is developed, that's a great question. I think parents do need to sign off on that. But I think it, certainly informally, if the school notices this as a concern, they could certainly take some steps to encourage the social confidence and help the child take some steps to speak, regardless of whether or not they are moving towards a diagnosis. Obviously, the recommendation would be to have an evaluation and meet with a provider who has experience in that area who can coordinate sort of the treatment team. But if that's not a possibility, I would say absolutely there are still things that you can do. And, you know, obviously the one, that beginning step is thinking about a treatment team and what could be involved, because the intervention for SM does tend to be more intensive in the beginning. I know the kids that I work with, I sometimes work with 2 to 3 times a week, or I consult on those cases a number of times during the week. And then as treatment progresses, I start to fade out that involvement. But so it can be absolutely something that is very time intensive in the beginning.
What goes into the meetings with a child, perhaps 2 or 3 times a week? Is there a preferred approach to working with children who have selective mutism?
Yes. So the research shows that exposure-based model or therapy is the treatment approach that has the most evidence at the moment, although research on SM is a little bit more limited than other conditions due to its rarity. But what we do know is that behavioral exposures and setting up a plan or a hierarchy with incremental steps is what we know works best for these kids, and I can describe that in more detail. So when we think about, you know, what does the word exposure mean? It basically is, how can we systematically approach and face feared situations? And there's two components to why exposures are helpful. So one piece is that as we stay in the situations we're uncomfortable in, the fear response eventually subsides, right? So our heart rate, our tension, stomach feelings, all of those physiological responses that we know kids with selective mutism do have a heightened physiological arousal to begin with. So they experience these sensations at a higher, more intense rate, right? So as we stay in those situations we're uncomfortable in, that response subsides. And the second piece is cognitive change, right? When we do something successfully, our thoughts about that situation change. So that situation becomes, instead of something fearful or something embarrassing or something I can't do, becomes something okay, something I am more comfortable with, something I realize I can cope with. And in engineering exposures within a school setting, we work on what's called fade-in procedures. And so this is another technique kind of within the umbrella of exposure work. And what stimulus fading involves is kind of fading in new individuals into the interaction and fading out the familiar or comfortable individuals out of the interaction. So I will work on a variety of different fade-ins. So transferring speech from me to the teacher, transferring speech from me to the guidance counselor to the teacher to a peer. So we'll work on starting in a comfortable place and moving towards something where we're having that other person enter the interaction. And it's done in a very specific way.
Okay.
And I can certainly describe more if you'd like about what a fade-in would look like.
And I think just giving another couple of examples of what exposure therapy actually is would be useful for the listeners.
Sure. So the most simplest example might be something very concrete, like a spider phobia, right? So if we're afraid of a spider, we tend to want to avoid any areas where there might be a spider. People might avoid going to parks, other areas where they think they might see a spider. They might avoid movies where they might see a spider, right? And so that avoidance, rather than keeping them safe and comfortable, actually long-term increases the fear. Because as you avoid that stimulus, you don't learn self-confidence and self-efficacy around the, oh, I was here, I did this, and I was okay. Nothing terrible happened. I did cope. So with exposure work, we're working on systematically working towards that end result, which is being nearby, maybe even holding the spider, looking at the spider, staying with that spider. And so there's often a gradual series of steps along the way. That may be looking at video clips of a spider. That may be touching something furry or closing your eyes and touching a furry model of a spider. That might be watching some spiders in a tank at a large distance and eventually moving closer and eventually watching as somebody else holds the spider and then moving towards touching the top of the spider and eventually holding the spider. And so what we're doing is we're building up confidence in a slow and gradual way with each step the person feels an increased sense of, again, the confidence that I can do it. The physiological response is like a wave. It peaks, but eventually it comes down. It's temporary. It does not stay. And so similarly, we work on this with children with selective mutism, where they may start off, maybe they're whispering one-to-one at the teacher's desk, and eventually the teacher tries to move towards them whispering a little bit closer to their peers and whispering to the teacher right next to their peers, and then increasing their voice volume. So it's a sort of gradual step-by-step process that they build towards those end results where they're speaking fluidly, openly, expressively in a variety of situations and settings.
You indicated that you might initially work with a child 2 to 3 times a week. Is that a standard that parents should expect that their child will be seen 2 to 3 times a week for a period of time?
So that is definitely the standard among many clinicians who do treat or are expert in treating selective mutism, that the idea is that the treatment is intensive in the beginning. Now, that frequency may only be for that first month, and it does vary. I certainly work with families that are unable to work with me 2 to 3 times, and we'll work with that, you know, and we can still make progress, although that progress might be slower. And the other thing to note is that this isn't typical traditional therapy in which I'm working with that child in the clinic setting 3 times a week. That may be the starting place as I transfer speech from the parent to myself, but then the goal is that I go into that school setting and work on transferring speech from myself to other individuals in the school. So the primary setting that I would typically be working in is the school. And many times I take a step back, and my goal is often to work towards more of a consultative role, by helping to train the guidance counselor, the school psychologist, or another trained one-to-one aide in working on these exposures with the child. And that is often a more feasible and long-term solution towards maintaining some of that intensive support for a period of time.
How likely is medication to be a part of the treatment plan?
Research has shown that SSRIs, which is a class of medication that can improve mood, reduce anxiety, can be helpful for children with SM. And in combination with the behavioral therapy that I'm discussing, it can often result in further gains. That being said, many parents of young children, as many of the kids that I see are 4, 5, 6 years old, are not ready, or in many cases not open to adding medication to the treatment approach and to our plan. And I work with parents whether they're interested in adding that piece and whether they are not. And I would actually say, and this is just from my own clinical experience, the majority of the families that I've worked with, the children are not medicated.
Okay.
And we make progress, and they move through treatment, and they complete treatment, and it goes well. But it depends, obviously. It depends on the individual child. Some children have more severe cases of selective mutism, and then in that situation, it can be very helpful. In other situations, we may be dealing with a second or third grader who has not been speaking in some social situations for now, you know, 3, 4 years of school. So to jumpstart treatment, it can be a great idea in that case as well. So, I educate parents in terms of the, you know, what's out there and what can be helpful. But ultimately, it's a personal choice, and families make different decisions as to whether or not they would like to add that piece to the treatment.
Dr. Raji, we're going to take a break in a few moments, but when we come back, I know that you developed an app for children, CBT Tools for Kids. So what I'd like for you to do when we come back is to tell us about the app, who you created it for, how parents can take a look at it, all those kinds of things. Again, folks, I am speaking with Dr. Veronica Raji, who is a clinical psychologist, and she is affiliated with Alvord Baker and Associates, a clinical practice in Maryland. We will be right back. Dr. Raji, before we talk about the app that you've created, I'm wondering if there is a typical age at which the experience of selective mutism shows up in a child.
Sure. Yeah, it tends to be between the ages of 2 and 5, often when the child starts some sort of formal schooling or even a daycare setting. Those tend to be the most common times. But in terms of the start of treatment, we see that treatment often starts around the ages of 5 to 8. So there is sort of this lag time in which I think sort of the process of parents observing, teachers observing, trying to really understand what's going on there. And so there is this bit of a lag there, which I would love to shorten that lag and get kids in earlier for the help that they need.
Sure. Tell us about the app that you've created.
Sure. Maybe I could talk a little bit about the app, and then I'd love to talk a little bit about the selective mutism camp that we've started here at Alvord Baker. The app is not specifically designed for kids with selective mutism, but is for any children who are experiencing strong emotions. It may be anxiety related, it may be anger, frustration, sadness, and it's a cognitive behavioral tool in that it's very aligned with the techniques and approaches of cognitive behavioral therapy, working with your thoughts and your feelings, your body responses to make changes to improve your mood, improve your understanding of the connection between all of those things. So what kids can do on the app is there is what we call a feelings thermometer. They can rate their feeling, whether it's anger or sadness or happiness. They can rate how strong that feeling is on a scale of 1 to 6. So give a number of different anchor points. And then they can take notes on what triggered their feelings. So there's a number of questions that they can answer in terms of what happened, what were the thoughts they have. So becoming increasingly aware of the thought process and triggers. And then there's a piece on tools. So I have relaxation skills, audios on there, so they can practice relaxing their body. I have a long list of coping actions. So they can kind of pick and choose, what can I do in this moment to self-soothe, to improve my mood. And then there is another section where they can kind of examine their thought. They have a list of different questions they can ask themselves. And then they receive some guidance or advice on what they can do, given the negative thought that they may have, to adjust that thought, to look at it in different ways. It's all based on CBT, and it's just a tool for kids to be able to track their thoughts and their feelings and gain a better understanding of those. And they can also connect with their therapist. So there's an email button, and they can send their ratings from the past week or the past month directly to their therapist via email, so that the therapist can also utilize that information in session.
It sounds like it would be ideal for some adults to take a peek at, too.
Yeah, people have said that to me before, and I think adults could use the tool as well. Certainly, it's geared and helpful for adolescents. Some of the examples in the notes page kind of are a little more geared towards kids, but really, yeah, anyone can use it. So hopefully it's a helpful tool, and I think can be helpful specifically for kids too in therapy to really make those connections and work with their therapist on increasing that understanding.
So how do parents and adolescents access this tool?
So it's available through iTunes. So you can just go, if you have iPhone, iPad, any Apple-related product, you can go and you can download it from iTunes. Unfortunately, I have not created an Android version yet, but certainly something I'm thinking about for the future.
It sounds like it's a must-have. Tell us about the summer camp.
Yeah, sure. We've been really excited about the summer camp at Alvord Baker. We piloted it this past August with a number of children with selective mutism. And we're really excited with the results that we saw. Kids had enormous boosts in confidence. And, you know, what we try to do, similar to other camps for selectively mute kids around the country, they're all modeled off of the Brave Buddies approach, which was developed up in Manhattan. These camps all function on these same behavioral principles, and we work with kids for a full week. And what we try to do is we do fun, engaging activities, but we also try to simulate a classroom environment. So they do circle time, morning meeting. We assign helper roles for them throughout the day. We have different projects and activities. We lunch together. So it's designed to map on to what they would be doing in a preschool or kindergarten classroom, or possibly first grade as well. And we work on our same fade-in approach, where we're gradually fading in new individuals to speaking with the kids. And while we had a small group last summer, all of them were speaking to everyone in the room by the end of the week. So we were really excited about that. And a lot of the success then generalized into the classroom as we continue to work with these kids through those first few months of school.
So this is a one-week camp?
So it's a one-week camp. So this summer it will start, it will be the week of August 28th. It will run from 9 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. And it's co-directed by myself and another great clinician here, Dr. Kelly O'Brien. And the camp, again, it has a variety of different really engaging activities. We have a fairy tale day. We have an animal day. We have glow-in-the-dark activities, sports, arts and crafts. There's also the piece of we're trying to create an environment that's exciting and salient so that as these kids consider speaking, the desire and the motivation is going to be really high to try to do so. The camp will, consistent with other forms of treatment for SM, we utilize a reward system throughout the camp. So we're rewarding and reinforcing for every instance of speech. And each child has a one-to-one counselor or volunteer who's with that child throughout the week. So there's a lot of support there for them to make those changes.
I know it's considered a camp, but as you describe it, it sounds like such a wonderful therapeutic environment. Does insurance cover any of it?
That's a good question. In our pilot group, I'm not sure who, if anyone did apply for reimbursement. It's certainly a possibility because it is coded. There is a treatment code for it. It is through our clinic. So certainly families could file for reimbursement. But that is a good question as to how often insurance companies do reimburse. But again, it's sort of anxiety disorder. It's coded as an anxiety disorder, and it's coded as group therapy. So there really should be reimbursement.
Well, and as I think about the remarkable results you've been able to experience in such a short period of time, I would think insurance companies would kind of eat up the opportunity to reimburse for it. But that's just my personal thought.
And I think it does. With SM, it's that intensive treatment can really make a huge difference. And right at the time point prior to starting school. So whereas I've seen many kids come to me who have been in treatment for a year, 2 years with very little progress, that have been doing the once-a-week traditional play therapy in the clinic setting, that costs, time and money and resources as well. So I think while more needs to be allotted and kind of put into the pot in the beginning to work with these kids through this evidence-based treatment approach, that it does work and we're making faster progress. Than otherwise. So hopefully insurance companies would be on board with that.
If a child with mutism goes untreated, might this experience continue into adulthood?
It's possible, although it's unlikely.
Okay.
While the selective mutism can persist, certainly without treatment, and can become ingrained for a number of years, by the time the child reaches high school, college, most often they've developed at least some capacity to speak in a variety of different situations. However, the emotional consequences as a result of selective mutism that has persisted for a long period of time can be considerable. And kids that have not been treated often then develop other anxiety disorders. Or they may be speaking, but the social anxiety is still very intense. They're still very uncomfortable. They still don't have good ways of coping. They experience problems in the academic realm, in the, you know, making friendships. So all of the associations with selective mutism can still very much be present as a child moves into adolescence and adulthood without treatment. But the actual not speaking becomes more rare when we're getting to those higher ages.
Okay. And I would think that certainly self-esteem takes a considerable hit the longer the child has the experience without treatment.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a huge, huge factor. And I've seen with many of the kids that I've worked with, as much as that fear has held them back for such a long period of time, there seems to be this wonderful lifting of a weight off of them when they start to be able to speak and develop that comfort and competency in these different situations.
And again, it's not useful at all for a parent or any adult to say to a child who is experiencing selective mutism, you just need to snap out of it, you just need to talk, or to assume that the child is being oppositional. That's not reasonable.
No, I'm glad you brought that up, because that is a really important point, that yes, we do not want to force, coerce, coax, demand the child to speak. None of those things will be helpful, because truly it is an anxiety disorder, and that can just cause further emotional consequences for the child. So when I had briefly mentioned this, the fade-in approach, those are ways to work very, very gradually to encourage the child to speak. So as we're, for example, when I meet a child with selective mutism in the clinic setting, I'm engaging in a fade-in that I would do in a very similar way in the school setting. They come in, I say hi to their parent, I say hi to them, I do not ask them a question up front, because if I do, I'm not going to get a response, and I'm setting up that cycle of non-responding. So I bring them into the room, and I have set up a number of different toys, and I let them and their parent play alone for at least 5 to 10 minutes. So I'm allowing the child and the parent to warm up together, and I'm encouraging the parent to ask a high frequency of questions during that time. Easy questions, generally either or questions, rather than questions that require a lot of elaboration. And so in this way, you know, we want to see the child's speech go up, feel natural, the child gets comfortable. And then part of the fade-in is I'm fading in terms of my physical distance from the child. So when I walk in the room, I don't walk in and sit right next to the play and start interacting. I walk in and I sit at a large physical distance. I pretend to do something else. I don't make eye contact. I might water my plants. And I allow the parent and child to continue to play. Most of the time, the child will continue speaking to the parent. Occasionally, their voice volume goes down a little bit. But most of the time, they continue that dialogue. And as they increase their comfort there and their tolerance of having me in the room, I eventually move closer. Once I get to a close physical proximity to their play, I will actually start using some skills that have been developed by parent-child interaction therapy, PCIT. It's a really common approach for treating children with oppositional defiant and disruptive behavior problems. It was originally designed to do that. But years ago, an expert in the area of selective mutism named Steve Kurtz, and he's up, he has a private practice in Manhattan, when he was at NYU Child Studies Center and then eventually at Child Mind Institute, he really worked on adapting the PCIT approach for the population of children with selective mutism. And so what this looks like in a fade-in is as I'm sitting near the child, I'm allowing the child to lead the play, and I'm describing what they're doing. I'm reflecting back their speech. So anything they say, I just reflect back, and I'm praising any specific actions that they engage in. And so what this is doing is this is a really critical step. I'm first building up tolerance to the child knowing that I hear him speak, I'm watching him. So I'm providing unconditional positive regard and attention without demanding or expecting any direct speech from him to me. And so this is a great mediating step before I ever even start asking a question. And I make sure that his responding to his parent and during the play in that context is pretty consistent before I attempt an easy question. And so there's sort of that's one example of a fade-in approach where we're really making sure that we're building the child's tolerance and comfort through these mini exposures along the way to eventually answering a question that I might ask.
You know, you've really given us in that description a very clear picture of what fading in looks like. We are just about out of time, and I'm wondering if there is a website that folks can go to if they'd like to get more information about what you're doing and about what Alvord Baker and Associates is doing.
Absolutely. So our website is www.alvordbaker.com. So Alvord Baker, Baker.com. That lists our resources, our clinical work. There's a link to the Selective Mutism Camp. We are also running booster sessions throughout the school year for children with selective mutism, as well as we do the individual work. In terms of education on selective mutism, a really great website is www.selectivemutism.org. So this is the Selective Mutism Association. It lists calendars of events in your area for selective mutism groups. It also lists providers or experts in selective mutism by state. It has different educational videos, has lists of book resources and other educational type informational different things that you can look into. So it has a wealth of information, so I really recommend that website.
It sounds like a wonderful site in addition to the Alvord Baker site. Dr. Raji, I have to thank you so much for joining us today and giving us such a clear sense of what is and is not the experience of selective mutism. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Pamela. I've enjoyed discussing and being part of this.
This is wonderful. And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is available to you on demand at mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. You can also sign up for the podcast through iTunes, or you can download the Mind Talk app through iTunes. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. And if you'd like to be in touch with me, the email address is Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. And again, that's mindtalk.org. And folks, always remember, if it's unacceptable, then it's unacceptable. You take care.